Okay, welcome to the third session on security and human behaviour. And the session chair for this session is Ben Laurie at Google. Ben,
hi there.
All yours.
This session's on fraud, and first up is Steve Murray.
Okay, thanks.
The collection of criminal-looking characters on the slide are not a selection of scanners to watch out for, but rather the students who did all the work. I'm not going to be... Sorry?
It might be the same thing.
Well, yeah, yes. I'm not going to be talking about the work that colleagues and I did with the Office of Fair Trading a couple of years ago, but rather a study in which we were trying to follow that up. But the same general principles applying, namely that we're interested in what psychological factors may underlie people falling for scams. In the OFT work, we concentrated largely on postal scams, partly because we wanted to do analysis of the discourse present in the scams, including the visual discourse, and telephone scams aren't good for that, and nor actually are most email internet scams, because they're mostly text only. Anyway, let's start with some underlying assumptions. In my initial draft of this talk, this slide was called The Bleeding Obvious, and I don't see any neoclassical economists present, so it probably is obvious to everyone. It's simply the underlying theoretical position I'm coming from as an economic psychologist, that humans do not take decisions according to elaborate optimizing procedures. We have to get through a complicated world, use a variety of shortcuts, like, he looks like a nice person, I'll do what he says, as we saw illustrated in the first talk this morning, or she looks like a person who needs some help. We have a series of shortcuts, and therefore our decisions are less than perfect. And any imperfect decision is open to exploitation by people with malign interests of one sort or another. And scammers are just malign people, bad people, as we've already heard, trying to get into the cracks created by our imperfect, necessarily imperfect decision-making processes and make them produce not just less than perfect, but actually positively bad and sometimes truly terrible outcomes, as when someone is, say, scammed out of their life savings or pension pot or something like that. So starting from those obvious assumptions, we have some obvious questions which we'd like to answer, though it turns out to be harder than you might think. One is, we have many, many heuristics we use to get ourselves through life. Are some of them more vulnerable to scammers than others? And are there particular scam types that are getting at particular heuristics? It seems obvious that there are, but can we document that? And are there particular people who are more vulnerable than others to scams? And if so, why is that? Is that because they tend to rely on particular decision heuristics? Is it something about their personality? Or is it all just situational and demographic, and if you're desperately poor, the thought that you might have won 300 million euros on a lottery you didn't enter is just so tempting that you can't resist sending off 20 quid? Okay, what we'll be doing in the current study, in previous work we were looking at general population samples, and I'm always in favour of looking at the general population, or as we psychologists tend to call them, real people, as distinct, that is, from psychology undergraduates, who are the usual subjects of our experiments. The problem with that work, however, was that to get any chance of getting any decent return rate out of a general population sample, you can only use a questionnaire of a rather limited length. You can't give someone a 12-page questionnaire. And indeed, if you want a representative population sample, you can't yet deliver by the internet, because the internet doesn't reach equally into all parts of society. So we did that. We limited questionnaire length, and nonetheless, we still got a lousy return rate, and hence actually a rather poor sample size, not allowing us to do much sophisticated analysis. So this time round, we tried to get a bigger sample and to deliver a somewhat heftier questionnaire by falling back on student samples and using internet delivery, which obviously, say, when you're getting low return rates, the costs of just getting postal questionnaires out begin to be serious. Now, the problem with student samples is, of course, that they're students, and they have limited life experience, especially the sorts of students you get at Exeter. Life experience largely limited to Surrey, and a few outstations of Surrey, like the Alps. They do, however, have some advantages. They're relatively homogeneous with respect to age and class and income, and indeed some of the violent gender differences of income and life opportunities that occur in real people samples are attenuated in student samples. They're also relatively internet savvy, so that seems quite good. And delivery over the internet seems a positive advantage if what you're fundamentally interested in, as we were in this case, is internet scams. Because people who don't have internet connection are very rarely suffer from internet scams. Anyway, we did all that and we got a sample that we could use of about 240 returns. We threw out all those that came from people who actually had some life experience, that is to say, those over aged more than 25. Exeter being a very traditional university, most of our students are young, so the mature student sample were probably going to be very different from the youngsters. It's not that there's anything less good about them, but they were such a minority, we thought they'd just mess up the analysis. So this is investigating young students. And we asked them about their experience with 13 different types of scam, and I'm not going to read them all out. And we asked them whether they'd ever had any of three types of experience with this scam. Whether they thought they were plausible, whether they'd ever given away any personal information that in retrospect seemed like a bad idea to such a scammer, and whether they'd ever lost money to such a scam. You might ask why the first question, and our thinking was that, you know, falling for a scam doesn't exactly reflect great credit on you, and if you want people to own up to rather discreditable behaviour, often a good way of doing it is ask them if they know someone else who's done this. It's the doctor, my friend has this problem syndrome. People will sort of hide behind another identity. Again, it wasn't a huge questionnaire. We asked three, and we gave a great list of sort of attitude questions that were designed to probe eight different kinds of what we're calling decision heuristics. Some of them don't look very heuristic, like susceptibility to social influence. That just means you take decisions by looking at what your friends do or what your friends are telling you to do. So we tried to probe eight different types of decision heuristic, each with a very short attitude scale. And then we picked up some simple demographics, age and gender, and the easy proxy for social class of origin, which is to ask people to think of the house where they grew up and then say how many bedrooms it had and how many people lived there. And the bedrooms per person ratio is a pretty damn good index of social class. And it avoids asking things that are either embarrassing or unknown, like how much did your parents earn. And we were trying to answer three questions, and I'm only going to talk about two of them because we haven't done the other one yet. These data are really absolutely only just in. Is there a covariance between reported compliance with different kinds of scam? So in other words, is there a general tendency to fall for scams, or is every scam different? And secondly, can either the demographics or the decision tendencies predict any of our compliance measures? Well, here are the data on levels of reported compliance. Of our 13 scams, how many did people say they report they'd fallen for? So you can see over here on the left, 40% of people didn't find any of the 13 kinds of scams plausible. And 70% of people said they'd never given away information in response to any of them. And then you get smaller frequencies, right up to 12. There's one person, or possibly two, who said they felt that 12 out of the 13 scams were plausible. The dotted lines so show fitted curves from a binomial distribution calculated on the mean number of scams complied with. And the reasons those curves are there are to show you that we have nothing like a chance distribution. Basically, there's, over and above the random variation, there's a strong tendency to be either a complier or not. If you fall for or feel is plausible one kind of scam, it makes it much more likely that you'll fall for or feel is plausible another kind of scam. The other thing to note is that 74% of people reported compliance of one sort or another. So this is not a scam-proof population. So if we believe people's reports, always a big if, we think it's reasonable to make a rough division of people into compliers and non-compliers. And the number of people we'd classify as compliers might vary from about 30% to about 60%. So we're not looking at a small minority of the population. That's very helpful. However, there is a major disjunction, which you'll have seen in the previous graph, between saying that sounds pretty plausible and saying I've actually fallen for it. Now, that could be self-presentation, or it could actually be the truth, and I'm not going to try and penetrate that matter. Rather, I'm going to move on to two next questions. Can we predict who's a complier and who isn't? So we just divided people into, according to our three different compliance definitions, into people who had complied with anything and people who had complied with nothing. Can we predict that? And secondly, if people have complied, can we predict how many scams they will have tended to comply to, assuming that someone who says that all 13 types of scam are plausible is a more serious complier than someone who says that only one is. However, how good are our tools for testing this? This just gives some psychometrics on our very short scales of decision tendencies. It's a measure that anyone who's done psychometrics will be familiar with, Cronbach's alpha, but basically it runs from 0 to 1, and a good scale will have a high level, and a bad scale will have a low level. Anything above 0.7 is regarded as usable for all purposes. Between 0.5 and 0.7 is usable with care, and below 0.5 you'd better go back and devise another scale. So you can see how we got out there, and we've clearly got to go back and devise some more scales of the last three kinds of heuristic we were interested in. That's not a common, uncommon kind of outcome. Nonetheless, with the tools we've got, how do we get on at predicting compliance? Well, very little seems to predict whether or not you'll say that scams are plausible. We just about got a bit of an effect of age. Older students, and remember this is in the age range 18 to 25 only, were more likely to say that scams, all types of scam, or at least some kind of scam, sounded plausible. Moving on to the more interesting kinds of compliance, this actually, we got nothing out of the demographics, but when we put in the decision heuristics, two of them popped up quite well in the analysis. The extent to which people were scaled as being susceptible to social influence, and the extent to which they said they were interested in rare or unique objects, things, or opportunities. That's quite interesting because the measurement of that last one was very poor anyway, but despite the poor level of measurement, we still got something from it. There was a marginal effect of risk preference. If we looked at losing money, whether people reported losing money, again, nothing from the demographics. The preference for the rare or unique popped up again. The other thing that popped up very strongly were measures of what I've called their lack of self-control. goes by many names. It's also known as impulsivity, impatience. I've heard somebody call it something else earlier this morning. I've forgotten what. It's generally speaking the inability to wait for something. And so that's not very surprising that that might pop up. Within people who said they have complied, we made no progress at all on predicting degree of compliance. So a second lot of conclusions, and this is my last slide. We used students on this project rather reluctantly, but actually it looks as though they might be quite an interesting population. I suspect because of their degree of internet exposure since quite a young age, many of them, they have quite a lot of experience with internet scams, and a very good proportion, well, bad proportion of them, depending on who look at it, have made at least some bad decisions in relation to internet scams. On all our measures of compliance, we do seem to get, if not, I call it distinct populations, that may be a bit of an exaggeration, but certainly if you complied with one, you're more likely to comply with another. So it suggests there is a dimension of compliance there that may be interesting. Our younger students were a little more sceptical, which may reflect the fact they're more internet savvy. You know, computer problems are all in the what I call the Groucho Marx class. This problem could be solved by a child of eight. Please send for a child of eight. Most interesting, the core thing, the psychological variables that in this sort of preliminary sweep, and it was a preliminary sweep, we want to retain for further investigation. This impulsivity, lack of self-control, impatience, time preference, call it what you will, variable, which that's jolly good because it's one I'm very interested in for other reasons. Susceptibility to social influence, no big surprises there. Preference for the rare and unique, and perhaps risk preference. Quite a good collection, all of them plausible. The other four we put in were also plausible, and that's a theme, beginning to be a bit of a theme. There are lots of things that might affect scam susceptibility. The problem is to find out which of them actually do. So this was very much a bit of a pilot, a fishing expedition. I'm probably going back next year to fish in a slightly more well-defined bit of water with those particular variables. Thank you. Escape or something. How do I stop it?
I'm very happy with your findings. They validate mine. So what could be better? All right. Take this, please. So, start at the beginning. There we go. So my general interest has gone from trust to trust and risk to risk communication, and I'm really excited that you're here, and John Adams and so many people who have inspired this work are here. So this is wonderful and intimidating. I want to better understand the risk perception, and I know that it is traditional practice in computer science to stand on the toenails of giants, but I decided to try to stand on the shoulders, and we basically took Slovic's dimensions of risk, nine dimensions of risk, and we said, which of these apply online? And we did a large survey with 15 computer security risks and said, can you rank these, and can you tell us how severe they are? Because we wanted to determine, you know, here's the dimensions of them, what predicts the perceptions of severity? So the immediacy of effect had by far the largest implication. The temporal issues were huge. Voluntariness, can knowledge about risk, both do I know about the risk, and knowledge about risk to science and the society. Do you remember how much scarier AIDS was when nobody knew what it was? And that's, can I control risk? Can I mitigate risk? Am I driving the car or am I sitting in the airplane? Is this a is this a new risk? Is it something I'm familiar with? Do I cross the street every day? Or am I jumping, am I driving for the first time? Is it dreadful? Will it give, that is to say, catastrophic? Will it scale? I mean, if I lose my information here, will it have huge influences? Is it dreadful? Is it, are you more afraid of being eaten by a shark or having some frozen chunk of something fall from the sky? And how severe are the consequences? So I only have like 3 minutes, so there's a whole bunch of paper. Basically, what we found is when we confined it into these categories and based on similarities into the set of variables, it was much more determined. The more familiar risk, can you read that? Oh, okay. The more familiar risks are less scary. The more immediate the risk is, the far more scary it is. If it's going to if I'm going to get hit by that truck now, So we went to lunch and we saw the lunch and we were like, there's the risk of being, of being hungry, and there's the risk of gaining weight. I don't know about you, but I really focused on the risk of being hungry and discounted the other future risk. So we see that a lot. Is it controllable? And one of the things that we found is this whole chronic common dread and severity really had nothing at all to do with prediction of risk. And I'm just going to argue with you, that's because nobody dies. I mean, when we're talking about severity, we're in such a tiny window. And this is a risk, a lot of the risk metrics have been used for things like, piloting your own airplane, civil aviation, lots of people die, right? Automobiles, you can die a spectacularly horrible death in an automobile, right? And I did actually go to a cybersecurity conference once where a general said about cyberterrorism, people have died on the internet. And I had to ask him, I said, what kind of peripherals do you have? They did not invite me back. I should have asked that. But anyway. So, and if it's controllable, the less controllable it is, the scarier it is. So how controlled is it and so we got the 77% P
0.01. To be fair, they do have peripherals that are actually weapons.
Yeah, that's true. He's a general. I was asking, It's like people, they laugh at my questions, but they're often very serious when you think about them. And then we looked at how people clustered risk, and we said, well, if they were technically accurate, we think that they would probably cluster them together. But they think botnets and zombies are very different. But botnets are a lot like phishing. So it seems that this clustering, we assert, is much more based on familiarity. That people look at threats, and if it's really familiar, they understand it, and they feel like we need to take action. So one of the things that we decided on was that we want to make, I've worked before in making risk visible, right? I spent like 2 years talking about this cube, so if you haven't heard it, it's not my fault. But anyway, and so one of the things that we have started working on now is trying to make risk imaginable. So you have to be very careful. I specifically work with students and old people. Students, because I'm mostly at a university and they're there, and elders, because they're very computer naive, they're often targeted for fraud. The population that we've picked is at Meadowood Retirement Community, and so they are wealthy and subject to fraud. So one of the things we took from this and is trying to make these frauds more visible. Let's see if this works. And we did that by making these little movies about phishing and keylogging. And here's a hint, it turns out looking at the ID doesn't help at all in this scenario. And then we have the success version. Helpfully labeled phishing success. Yeah, Just some basic information. I like that. You want me to write that down for you? Did you hear that? And then we have the fail.
I didn't hear what you said. Sorry.
He said, oh, can I get your birthday, date of birth, your social security number, and where you bank, just to be sure. And he said, oh, you want me to write that down for you?
Okay, this is back to you. Now, if you find something in there, I'm going to give a call to the bank if you don't mind. And I want to find out if they see it.
Yeah. So the second time he calls a bank, and then we have a keylogger video there. We have 6-minute videos that you have to watch. We're building it in a browser. The first time you do something that we estimate to be risky. And then there are the 30-second reminder videos if you do something that is medium risk. And then there's the little still that says, do you really want to invite this person in your house? Do you really want to tell this person your details? And that way we're trying to frame it so that the risk seems immediate and the risk seems familiar. So, thank you.
And next is Jen Schechter.
Sorry.
It's kind of cool, whatever it is.
Hell.
Red light.
Okay. So, this is the third time I've been to SHB. It's the third time I'm not talking about fraud. I'm not going to speak about fraud today. It's the third time that Ross has put me in the fraud session. So, I'm kind of wondering if there's some message I should be taking away from this. So this is actually work that was led by an intern at MSR a year ago, Jen Tam, who's at Carnegie Mellon. Rob Reeder and I were her mentors. So this is work I'm going to talk about the trying to present information to users when they're about to do something potentially risky. And in this case, it's installing an application. So this is the motivation cartoon. I'll give you 10 seconds to read it. Is it legible?
Yeah.
So he's looking to see whether it's saying if you install this app, it's going to get all of your internet banking records, medical and medications. But he really wants to do the super poke, so he installs it anyway. So this, unfortunately, is our ideal scenario. Because in this case, at least it's an informed consent, which is extremely unlikely in most of the situations where you'll be installing an app. If you take the way that the Facebook app model works, it provides all this neat detail. It's going to pull profile information, photos, friends info. It sounds like it's giving you specific information about the app. It's not. It shows this exact same message regardless of what the app is. It's just providing you some illusion that there's some detail that's actually required by that the app has to give you. It's the same every time. This is the OAuth. OAuth is a new standard for authorization on the web, and it's a situation where OAuth apps are supposed to explain what they're doing, and in this case, there's another paragraph that says it's going to be able to access and update your data. Google does a nice job of this with Android. In this case, they've got these bullet points with these exclamation marks that tell you what an app will potentially be able to do if you install it on your mobile phone. And they're organized by the resource that is your location of the system tools, and then the actions are listed below. For the too much information, you've got Microsoft's Health Vault, also a web app model. And here you're seeing that they've organized it by action. The top set of things are things that the app will be able to read and update, and the next ones are read, update, create, and delete. So here again, huge amounts of information. And there's a question of what's the right way to do this? So how do we, if we actually want informed consent, how can we actually best present that information? And there's a bunch of questions we'd like to ask. The ideal one is what disclosure design is going to help users make the best decision. And I'd love to be able to do a study on that. In that case, I'd actually have to have an app that people used, and I'd want to do some kind of test in the real world. But then I'd, you know, to get the right success metric, it would be real world performance. So I'd have external validity issues for any app other than the one I was running, because this would get me an app specific, what people would do for this type of app, so people might behave differently for Facebook apps than for, say, things they installed in their phone. And I'd have an ecological validity issue if I weren't to do this on actual real world participants. So I actually need to be one of the folks who gets to run these one of these platforms that takes apps. I'd love to measure, do users understand the underlying concept? The problem with any learning task in a psychology study is that the moment someone's learned something, you have to throw them out as a participant. You can't ask them if they can learn the thing again. So you'd like to do a between subject study. And if you're going to do a between subject study and say 40 people for each treatment or 30 people for each treatment, and you want to have 20 treatments or something, you have to. That's going to be a 40 times 30. That's going to be huge. So unless you're doing an MTurk study where you're not going to understand your participants as well and be able to watch what they're doing, that's just not practical. So what we did study was how quickly can users search and absorb the facts that are being disclosed in the disclosure. So this is just, you know, information presented, how quickly can they find out what that information means. So we would show them things like this. Here we're saying, you're going to see a bunch of presentations, they're going to look something like this, and we need you to answer afterwards what questions about, say in this case, whether the app will be able to see your videos, change your events, or delete your events. In this case, it could change the events, but not delete the events. And so they would then see something like this, a set of resources and actions, and then we'd make it disappear, and based on that amount of exposure time and the amount of information they were able to glean, they would have to answer the question. We gave them a high-tech input device to do this. It had from no to yes with some probabilities and not sure in the middle. And then they could hit the button, and in this case, they answered the correct answer, and we'd let them know, and then we'd let them see again the information so that they could confirm. And in fact, we had a couple of bugs that this helped us discover when they had in fact answered correctly, and this told them they hadn't. So this was a useful process. So that was to see how quickly they could absorb. The other thing you might want to do if you're going through a disclosure is look for something where you really care about one piece of information and you want to find out whether this action you don't want to have happen could happen. And so that would be a search task. And so in that case, we give them the question up front. Then we'd here's the question up front. And then we present the information. And the moment they had their answer, they press the button. And so that way we could find out how quickly they were able to do these things. So 24 trials for each design. We had 8 long absorption, 8 short absorption. These times were chosen so that people would be able to get the information about half the time. We did a pilot study, and we knew it was half the time, roughly half the time, because if they were able to get the correct answer 3/4 of the time, that meant they were doing halfway between guessing and perfect. So that's what we were shooting for, and you'll see that in the scores. We also had 8 search trials. Of course, we didn't have to pick a time for that because they had as much time as they wanted. And what we looked at were different... first I should say we looked at 2 different types of information. You could just present the resources that an app would have access to, or you could present a combination of actions, resources and actions that can be performed on those resources. So there were 5 general formats. One was this bullet point format, kind of like Android. One was a table format. There's research, prior work that says people like tables, they do well on tables. There's paragraphs. There's these icons that Jen came up with that are really quite nice. These were all in the context of Facebook because it's easy to find Facebook users out there. And then there's actual images of the data. So if it was a news feed, we'd show you a picture of a news feed. Photos, we'd show you pictures of photos. So those were the 5 general layouts that we used. We also modified things in some variants where we changed whether in the left you'll see that these are organized by resource, and for each resource there's a set of actions that can be performed on the resource. Alternatively, you could organize things by actions and then show for that set of actions what resources are those actions allowed on. And as I said, these things, we picked some stuff out of Facebook to use for the study. We generated these questions randomly. I'll look through the related work for time. We had 33 Facebook users, roughly equal age groups and such. Naturally, as you would expect, the more information there was in each of these presentations, the less you could absorb, and so the scores would go down. Similarly, for time, the more information there was, the longer a time it took to answer for the search questions. Now, we were hoping that we'd find certain designs were much better than others. And what we found generally, so these are the results. You can see the blue lines are short absorption, the red lines are long absorption. These things don't vary too much. So a 0.5, a zero score is what you'd expect with random. A one score is perfect, and a negative one means they got everything wrong. They generally stick around the 0.5 line, which is, as I said, that means we're doing as best we can in terms of getting a time that will get us good data we can use to differentiate these. Similarly, for times, we did find people did very well in these icons in terms of being able to search them quickly. So that was the one thing we really got out. In fact, for icons, for the icon-based treatments, and generally the visual ones in general, people did very well with the visual ones. We asked them what they liked. They also liked the two visual ones almost universally over all the others. So the ones they found the easiest were the images and the icons. The table was a very distant third, and pretty much everything else was the paragraphs and the outlines, which are the best practice today, were despised. Similarly, in terms of search performance, very much the same result. And the ones they would choose for real world use, images, icons, and some people thought the table would be useful. So guidance based on this was, one, if you're going to group by either the resources or action, people seem to go for the resource, like things organized by action. This may be sort of a result of how the English language works. You don't say that you resourced an action. You don't say that you zooed to the went. You say you went to the zoo. And so this may just be that our brains have all been treated to deal with action resource better. Verb now. We found generally that these graphical representations people liked a lot and performed better on because they were easier to visually search than text. And that they liked them, they felt easier. So, you know, we would have ideally liked to figure out which of these presentations would get us the best result in terms of people making the best decisions with their applications and making the best security and privacy decision based on the disclosure. You know, what we mainly found is what they prefer, and there weren't huge differences there. But what users prefer makes a lot of difference, because if you're going to get them to make good decisions based on the disclosure, you at least minimally want them to pay attention to it. And the more they like it, the more they're going to pay attention to it. So that's, I think, all we have. I do have a backup slide for responding to any questions. I expect, you know, to get the typical questions, and I always like to have a strategy for how I'm going to handle them.
Okay, next is Chris Paper.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's a real pleasure to be here. This is an exciting workshop, and it's interesting to see everyone's different background and different perspectives brought to bear on these issues. My background is in law, and one of the issues I've been looking at for years now is identity theft, and I've moved a significant way from where I started. And my most recent paper on identity theft I call Internalizing Identity Theft, and it's about identity theft as an externality. In the U.S., basically identity theft is dealt with in two ways. We have criminal sanctions, and over the past 15 years or so, we have a steadily increased criminal sanctions for identity theft. And in fact, identity theft can now be a terrorism crime. So we've created very big incentives to get law enforcement to look at identity theft, yet only about 1 in 70 identity thieves is ever arrested, according to Gartner. And even those that are arrested, only about half actually end up going to jail. So this is a high reward, low risk crime. The other way we deal with identity theft in the US is through education. I think it's a complete waste of time. It basically doesn't work, because what we tell people in the US is, don't share your social security number. Try it. Just try it sometime. You won't have utilities, you won't have a driver's license, you won't have anything that matters in the world. So we can't make a clear message for consumers to take up, and so it doesn't work so well. Now, in the at least in the legal literature, there tends to be two different ways of framing identity theft. Dan Solove talks about the idea of the architecture of vulnerability. So this is a house that's just about to fall over because its foundation is poorly designed.
Somebody really built that. We need a photoshop
that. No, this is a real slide. So Dan years ago said, you know, really what's happening in the U.S. is we have identity theft because there's no architecture to protect personal information. It's all just out there. Anytime or another, someone can steal your identity. There's nothing you do. And then on the other side, Lynn Lopucky argued in a very influential article almost 10 years ago that really what the problem of identity theft is that we live in a crowd, a masquerade ball. We can't recognize each other. And so the identity theft problem is that creditors are looking at this population of headless people and cannot differentiate them. So in fact, privacy is the problem. Privacy is causing identity theft under the Lopucky model. One of the interesting things about identity theft literature is, especially in the economics space, this paper is really, really popular. And you can just flip to the references section and you'll see it cited. If you see this paper cited and not Dan's, it's a bad paper. So how did I get where I was going? I thought both of the models didn't really work that well. I see identity theft as a problem of incentives and credit granting. So this is actually Dan Solove's mail for 1 year. He gets 180 credit card offers a year. Okay, so I said, stop throwing them away. Put them on your desk and take a picture for me. Because when you start looking at some of the crazy things in credit granting, you wonder how hard exactly identity theft can be. This is an example of this prankster who got a pre-approved credit card offer, ripped it up, taped it together, filled it out, and sent it in using his parents' address rather than his address, and the card shows up. So I decided that we should start looking at credit grantors and credit grantor behavior rather than the problem of personal information out there. So under amendments to the Fair Credit Reporting Act in the United States, a victim of identity theft can write to the bank at which, or the institution more broadly, at which their identity was stolen and get the documentation, get all the account records, the application, etc., all the different information that the imposter generated in stealing that individual's identity. So I got some victims together and we made these requests for this information. And we weren't studying the victims. We were studying how these institutions authenticated people. This is normally part of like a 40-minute talk where I go into the methods in greater detail. And the benefits of a short talk is that I don't get to talk about my methods, so you can't kind of get ready. So, I mean, it's so quickly. Because the methods are a little scary. This is really, really hard study to do. Identity theft thieves victims tend to become very paranoid, and it was very hard to recruit people into this. But what we saw was that every single application for some type of financial services product had errors that were indicative of fraud. The most common error was a wrong address. And when I say wrong address, I don't mean transcribed house number. I'm talking about an address that the victim never lived at. Another big theme we saw was that, at least in our population, we saw a lot of marginal financial services. So it was payday loans, credit cards at bad deals, and also mortgage loans that no rational consumer would sign up for. I mean, I'm talking about mortgage loans at 11% interest, this type of thing. you do that. Someone would do that. Okay, well, I'll make you a loan. One of the interesting things for further research is that I got to look at lots and lots of credit reports in doing this study. And I tell you, I can look at a credit report and tell you whether the individual is a victim of fraud. I think I can do this. But I want to. I actually want to do this empirically. And so this is a great research idea, is to see if you can build a computer model to detect identity theft within the credit report with no extrinsic information. Because I'm telling you, I could look at these credit reports and say, this person is a victim of fraud. And it was usually pretty obvious. You'd see something like this. Subject 4 pays all their bills on time for years. And at the very end of the credit report, they have 20 completely unpaid obligations. As in, they haven't made one payment. And that's a pretty strong sign of fraud. What's interesting about this and in identity theft research more generally is that if you can prove this to be true, and if you could build a model to look at fraud within credit reports, you could have substantial policy interventions. You could essentially require credit reporting agencies to do this work on behalf of consumers if you could prove this is true. Let me just talk about subject number 6, who's actually become public, and then I'll sum up. Subject 6 went public with his participation. He, as a victim, had a new credit card issued to him. The only correct information in the application process was a social security number, but his name was misspelled, and there was some other funny things going on with it. Here's the actual credit application. This is a successful credit application. Name is misspelled two different ways. There's no metadata. The signature is wrong. And, you know, typically when you grant credit, you keep a copy of the driver's license or whatever credentials presented, not kept. So this victim is kind of in the dark. There's no way you could actually get this imposter, right, if this is all you got. When we looked at these victims, we found similar problems, really sloppy applications with lots of errors. I go into in the paper about why credit grantors might overlook fraud, and it basically comes down to the idea that there are hundreds of millions of applications for credit, and many of them are successful, and a very small number of them are fraudulent. And the economic cost of doing more fraud screening is quite high. I do some estimates in the paper, but for instance, a completely automated credit granting, like what this guy got, these types of credit applications are done in a completely automated way, no human interaction. Okay, the human is opening the letter and scanning in the application, and the computer decides. Okay, front to end. Well, you can do that for between 5 to 15 pounds. And the second you get the fraud people on the phone, the costs at least triple. So overlooking fraud can be quite, there are a lot of incentives for overlooking fraud. There's a number of weaknesses in my study. I have a very small sample. Many of my victims came from a identity theft remediation company called Identity Watchdog. So I had kind of a sample of individuals who had extreme examples of identity theft. And I didn't have a control. Another problem with this type of work is even legitimate credit applications sometimes have errors on them. And we have no way of controlling them, too. At least I don't. And just to sum up, my paper argues that we need to move out of a negligence framework, which is currently not working. And most victims of identity theft who sue banks for opening cards or whatever to imposters lose. And the argument from the court's perspective is that there's no duty. You're not an account holder with our bank. It's unclear what exactly a reasonable level of care would be. All sorts of other problems. One you see in a lot of the cases is the court will simply say there's no harm. So the courts see your time as free. And so in the paper I conclude that we need to move to a strict liability situation because issuers are in complete control of the credit granting process. And in fact, one of the implications of my paper is that there's really no way for consumers to avoid identity theft. And if you looked at some of these applications, there's no amount of secrecy you could have engaged in, et cetera, to protect yourself against it. In fact, one of and I'll sum up this. One of my victims was a multiple victim of mortgage loan fraud, and where all of the consumer reporting agencies said, this is a fraudulent application, that the addresses don't match, the date of birth don't match, and six loans were made in her name for over $1 million. So with that, I will sit down and look forward to your questions.
So, any idea how to make this computer work? Okay.
Great.
All right. Hi, everyone. So, I'm a computer scientist. I do most of my research in sort of empirical studies of online crimes and frauds. However, I also do some work looking at sort of policy for cybersecurity and policies for improving cybersecurity and information security, and that's kind of led me into this work, which is that there is an increasing level of interest among states in information security and cybersecurity and cyber war, and so I think if we're going to recognize that fact, then we need to do something about it and start to understand what the trade-offs are now that states are involved in cybersecurity. And so the main motivation here is, you know, computer scientists used to study security by first stating assumptions about how a system should work and how an adversary might break that system. This worked great for designing encryption algorithms. It kind of fell apart whenever the internet came along. Because all the attacks violated the assumptions of that we were making. So then to deal with that, we came up with the idea of a strategic adversary and strategic defense. And so we started using tools like economics to understand how systems break down and why they break down. But even in this context, we tended to think of distinct attackers and defenders. You have the good guys and the bad guys being separate. But now that we've got state involvement, things are changing again, and that you have an actor who can choose between attack and defense, choose between investing in offensive operations and protection. And so so what we're seeing is in the United States, we have something as recently formed called Cyber Command, which is a unified U.S. military command that's in charge of all cyber military efforts. It's led by the director of the NSA. However, the NSA also has a defensive role in the U.S. They help to help protect our U.S. information infrastructure. For instance, Google has a very famous espionage case that came about in January this year. The NSA assisted with that investigation. They've, for several years now, have advised Microsoft on its new developments of operating systems to try to improve its security. So you have a single organization here which is responsible for using IT as a weapon, but also as a duty to protect it. So there's some obvious tensions here. And so what we've tried to do is sort of look at those tensions in a particular concrete context to try to understand the issues that are at play. And sort of at a higher level, you kind of have three main areas where if you're going to think about cyber attack and defense. First of all, I think it's really important to actually have some awareness of the technical considerations that play a role here. I mean, there are definite trade-offs, but you actually need to dig into details and figure out what particular scenario you're looking at. So, for example, we have things about vulnerabilities and exploits. If a vulnerability is made public, then that can be used to protect systems, whereas hidden vulnerabilities are often used in zero-day exploits. And so there's a series of different conditions and series of realities of how information security works, which you need to be cognizant of. And then you also need sort of a number of different scenarios where an attack and defense trade-off could take place. And finally, there's lots of different methods for studying these trade-offs. Game theory is an obvious choice, but there's obviously also psychological factors that explain why you choose to tend to want to invest in attack versus take a more defensive posture. And today, what I'm interested in talking about is our initial effort, which is just looking at a particular scenario, which is vulnerability information, and what to do with a newly discovered vulnerability, using a game theory can model the strategic interaction. Part of why I'm talking about this to you here is because I realize that this is only one way to do it, and I think there's tons of psychology going on here, so I'd really be interested in your feedback for other ways that we might study these trade-offs. So we're going to look at a vulnerability stockpiling scenario where suppose you have two actors, call them, you think of them as states, who are out have investing and looking for vulnerabilities in systems. Once they discover a vulnerability in a system, they can decide either to stockpile, meaning keep that in their arsenal of exploits that can be developed and then used secretively against an adversary, or they can defend, which means disclose this vulnerability to the relevant software developer, try to improve and fix the hole. But the catch is, if you choose to fix the hole, it helps everybody. It doesn't. You can't do both. You can't release. You can't talk to the software provider and still try to use it for an offensive purpose. And then there's a couple of parameters we trade off in the model, which I'm not going to get into too much detail on. But the key things that we found is looking at this, the relative sophistication of the players. So obviously you might have one state which is better at discovering vulnerabilities than the other, and we reflect this in this parameter P. So if the players are more equally situated, then the P takes a value of 0.5. If one player is better than the other, then you get a larger or smaller value. And then the other is sort of this delta, which is we also value from 0 to 1, which is what captures the social cost and social harm, because it may be that it's beneficial to a state to hold on to vulnerability information, but meanwhile you've got society that is running in, insecure computers, which can lead to fraud and all kinds of problems. And this is an externality which causes problems. So we model that in the game with different values, and so we have different payoffs. Basically, you get a payoff of 1 if you choose to stockpile and you're the only one who discovers this vulnerability. Payoff of -1 if the other player discovers the vulnerability and you don't, and you get a normalized value of 0 if you chose to disclose the vulnerability. This is what you get for different Nash equilibria for different values of the parameter. So the orange is sort of the stockpile outcome. On the x-axis we have the P, which is the value of the relative sophistication of the players, and delta is the social cost. So in the middling values of P of 0.5 mean the players are evenly matched. If social cost is ignored, meaning you have a delta of 0, then everyone's just going to stockpile vulnerabilities. It's only once you start to force the players to consider the social cost of keeping these vulnerabilities hidden that you might start to get one of the players to choose to defend and to disclose the information. It's often the weaker player, which is why you see, in the case you get one player will choose to defend if their p-value is smaller, meaning they're relatively weaker, even for smaller social costs. This is a sort of a toy model to try to get at some of the initial tensions that are at work here and understanding the trade-offs between what an actor should do between disclosing or not disclosing this information. I've covered most of this. Some of the main takeaways really are that if the player is going to ignore the social cost, then stockpiling is what results. As more social costs are internalized, you get bigger values of delta, one player is going to choose to defend instead of stockpile. And one kind of interesting consequence is if you are in a situation where one of the players allows a situation where there's lots of social harm, for instance, there's an accusation that the Russian government tacitly condones lots of cybercrime taking place in its borders because it harms others. This could actually, if you have a large delta value, a large social cost, this could lead to a more defensive outcome taken by the military. The final thing is, we assume that you have good information on the actual value for the other players. Of course, this is impossible. This is not possible always. And so, if you underestimate the sophistication of the other player, then this can lead to unfortunate outcomes. In the interest of time, I'll just cut it off at that. But really, the main point of this is, you know, cyberspace is becoming militarized. We have lots of state interests. This is really changing the game in terms of the interactions between attack and defense. It's no longer just good guys and bad guys. It's guys who can do good and bad. We need new ways of studying this trade-off. This is a start. But thank you for your attention.
Okay, questions?
Take into account the very important survival action abilities,
the
difference between if player A has
an ability. Yes. So one of the things that's in the model which I didn't talk about is there's a probability of rediscovery. And you can even, rediscovering the vulnerability, this can either be captured by P, in that if you're the more sophisticated player is likely to rediscover, but it can also be introduced sort of exogenously. And we have a later game that has that as a separate variable. But that's one of the key trade-offs. Is if you may discover it and keep it hidden, but you don't know if the other player also has discovered it. In that case, you don't get as much of a gain.
I had a question about Stephen's example, I can see all the reasons for using students and other reasons in psychology, but in this particular case, what do we know about the profile of victims of scams? How does it correlate with intelligence and with wealth and with other forms of vulnerability? We know that poor people, less intelligent people, for example, get sick at a hugely greater rate than other people in our community. I suspect that they also being scammed at a greater rate than others. And, is there any evidence on that?
Yes, and OFT and the AARP in the US have done prevalence studies on scams generally, and with the predictable sorts of results, the rates of victimization are higher among people who are older, people who are socially isolated, so living alone maybe, people of lower educational standing. However, AARP, which used to stand for the American Association of Retired People, therefore has a very particular interest in this area and has done some of the best research on it. However, I always, in my discussions with OFT, discourage them from making too much of that fact, because it's only a tendency. And, well, two reasons. First, it's only a tendency, and people of all ages, classes, intelligences, and so on do fall for scams. And the second, the linked reasons, is that your biggest enemy in this, in trying to protect people or help people protect themselves, is complacency. One of the most exasperating tendencies is that people who know a bit about an area are more likely to be scammed in that area. So people who see themselves as a digital investment expert are much more likely to fall for investment frauds. Now, there is a reason for that, because they're actually more likely to be going into, investigating investments. There may well be people who need to go to think about investment because, let's say, they've got a private pension fund which they need to invest in and so on. Nonetheless, knowledge of an area does not protect you, and being scammed is certainly not the prerogative of the old and stupid. It just gets worse for the likes of you and me as we get more and more. One other thing about that, as regards internet scams, of course, the age distribution is different, because although there are plenty of silver surfers out there, it's still the case that internet use is more prevalent among younger people. So if you're concentrating specifically on internet scams, going to the old isn't particularly a good idea. And students may not be such a bad sample either, because I introduced it by saying that falling scan compliance, falling for scan, is a kind of bad decision. It's specifically a bad financial decision. And one of the things we know about teenagers and young adults is that they're financially incompetent. I've done a lot of work on student debt and therefore on student money management, and also on chronic and serious debt in older people. And the thing about students is they make a lot of financial mistakes, but generally speaking, they're either going on to reasonably well-paid jobs or they come from reasonably wealthy families, and therefore they recover from their mistakes. But when you talk to people in their 30s or 40s who have never been out of debt, and I'm talking about real grinding debt, since they made a few financial blunders in their late teens or early 20s, you realize that the consequence of young adult financial stupidity can actually be lifelong. So actually, I don't think students are at all as bad a sample as I initially thought they were. I mean, like most psychologists in social areas, I have a prejudice against student studies. But I think in this case, they may actually be well worth doing.
Okay, one, two, three.
My question is for Stephen, kind of a follow-up. You found when you queried people a covariance among the different types of scams.
Yeah.
If you have a tendency to fall for one, you do it. But here's the question, and it is a question, because I don't know the answer to it. But if you were to look in the non-student population, or students in the real world who have been victimized, it'd be curious to know whether if people have a greater tendency to fall for one scam, they're more likely to be scammed. Having experienced being scammed, do they then not learn and they're more likely to? You see, you could actually in the real world see a negative covariance. That is, that it would be, you experience the scam, you would learn from it, and be less likely to fall for the next one. You wouldn't pick that up in an experiment, but you would see it in the real world.
I think that may be so, and you'd need to get much more detailed statistics than we've yet found a way of getting from a sort of general population sample. However, two things about that. The first is that while there is covariance, certainly in this sample of no doubt not very serious victims, when you look at really bad scam victims, they're mostly specialists. People specialize in being scammed by clairvoyants, they specialize in being scammed by lottery things. In some cases, it's because it's a minority, but it's an interesting minority. They're essentially treating it as rather like a lottery. You know, if I go into the UK National Lottery, last time I looked, the chances of winning were 1 in 14 million, which is not very good. But if I won it, it would totally change my life. And if my life is a total mess financially, it's worth the risk. And some people treat scam offers like that. They're 95% sure it is a scam, but hey, if they had won those 300 million euros, it would get them out of all their problems, and it's worth 20 quid for the risk. So you do get specialists like that. But the other thing is that...
That suggests that they're overestimating small probability.
Well, yeah, you can do the standard risk, gambling preference analogies on it, analysis on it. But while some people may learn, there undoubtedly are people who never learn.
I think one of the determiners would be you look at how they score on that impulsivity scale.
Yeah.
Because I think that really impairs learning.
Yeah. I certainly didn't. I mean, I was very, very pleased when impulsivity came out there because everything theoretical says that ought to be a really major.
No, I agree. Really
thing in that.
Catherine.
Question for Tyler. Did you look at a situation where one side could arrange by a matter of policy for the creation or widely deployed vulnerabilities intentionally?
Widely deployed vulnerabilities intentionally? not in this case, no. I mean,
we just have sort of the simple thing. I've heard all these stories, you hear your stories, people talking about how the NSA is collecting zero-day exploits, and this is, they're using this to their advantage. Is that your people in DC telling me this? And so we kind of took that as inspiration for what we chose to model.
Yes, just as Chris was setting up, I checked my email and I had some happy news for an unpaid lockup. I've just won £1 million. So you spoke, Chris, of low risk, high reward activities with respect to identity. And I suspect this another one in that category. And what puzzles me, given the frequency with which I receive these prizes, is it risk-free to the scammer? I don't know. I mean, there's clearly evidence of a scam. He must be committing a crime. Is there no one out there chasing people like this?
There are, and I should, in just 10 minutes, I can get fully paint my subject. Mine only deals with new account fraud, whereas that fraud is probably a phishing of an existing account situation. And there are some specialists in it, but I don't know much about how frequently there's a prosecuted or even really investigated. I think it's mainly dealt with filtering at this point. I think that's how that's dealt with. And increasingly, banks are stepping in to protect their own users from some of this. Large money transfers to suspicious places. When you change your credentials, a lot of banks will not allow you to do a large transfer for 15 days or something.
So I would also say I don't believe anyone. I don't think I've been in any arrests of someone running lottery scams. So it's awesome, right?
So the thing is, no one cares in the sense that people care about phishing. And so someone cares. A bank cares that someone has got a fake website impersonating Barclays or whoever. So Barclays tries to do something about it. Lotto scam, there's no equivalent party to really go after it. You have to rely on the police to do it, and it's difficult. It trails back to the internet. It inevitably comes international because the email has come from a compromised computer that's probably in Spain, linked to another compromised computer in Morocco, and who knows where. And so this sort of thing just doesn't get investigated in any kind of priority.
If I could just come in on that, I mean, the international aspect, it's quite clear that where the crime is perpetrated in one country and the victims are in another, then I won't say the law enforcement authorities don't care, but the extent to which they care goes down a step. For example, the major lottery scams in Britain the major postal lottery scams come in, are based on the Spanish lotteries. And they come in envelopes with actual Spanish stamps stuck on them. Now, somebody is buying very, very large numbers of stick-on stamps. And you're not telling me that the Spanish authorities couldn't spot that. But they're not trying.
I suspect Richard has a thing or two to say about this and the internet.
Well, I was going to say that some of that is, I think, what they get the money mules to do before they become money mules is to get to do some stick on stamps, so they get to use I got when you stand in for somebody's going to inherit in a will, scams, which was actually printed on an inkjet and posted to me with a Cambridge postmark. I just turned up the other day with a reply to a Yahoo email address and so forth. But what I was going to say is I was concerned about your study and the fact that you found your people said that the number of the scams were rather implausible. Because we don't know a great deal about criminals, but what we do know suggests that there are quite a lot of independent entrepreneurs who are choosing to spend their time on this because it's profitable and much more fun than sort of being penniless in downtown Lagos or wherever. Right, so they're choosing to do these things, and they're choosing whichever scanner they do on the basis that they're vaguely competent at it, and they can turn a penny or two at it. And there's no point in them doing a scan which just doesn't work. They're not going to do it for very long, they're going to move on and try something else which actually works. So if your study group are saying all of these things are implausible, nobody could possibly fall for it, then that suggests that you've got a whole lot of other people to find who you need to study, who are going to actually consider this extremely likely, and of course people would get involved in that sort of operation.
Just a comment on that. The first thing is that actually, of course, the whole thing about internet scams is that not many people have to find them plausible. It's the low cost of originating issue, because you can send out millions of them. But you have to reckon with a degree of self-presentation among our subjects, in that the questionnaire was headed in large letters, "This is a questionnaire about internet scams." So they were being told before they began that all of these were scams. They were in a frame, and they were all essentially real materials. So these were not stuff we had made up, that we cast them into a sort of consistent kind of framework. But people were, people knew in advance these were scams, so they were being asked to take a cold decision. Does this look like the sort of thing someone would fall for or not? So clearly there's an element of things which says, well, I don't fall for that. So yeah, always take self-reports with a pinch of salt. However, the trends in self-reports are more reliable, completely reliable, more valid than the absolute values, of course.
Okay, Angela, did I miss that?
I just wanted to bring up this effect, not overlooking that a lot of these attacks actually really successfully exploit automatic behavior on behalf of the users. So basically, I was thinking about the boilerplate scams, which basically target highly literate, well-aware, financially successful people. Bringing them up, and they basically pump shares, allegedly buying a share. And basically these people respond because they get calls from brokers like that several times a week, right? And they're saying exactly the thing that a normal broker would say to them. It's the same story, and you do that plus a bit of the need and greed principle from Frank's paper in there, and basically people don't have a lot of time, they have to make a quick decision, and if it's more plausible than not, then they'll go for it. And I think it's that again, on the internet also, basically if the email you're getting looks similar, to the email that your various departments send out, or that your bank sends out to you, and you're under time pressure and you just want to deal with it and move on, then you're just gonna hit that button. And I think it's sort of like, I worry a bit about just reading too much, talking about the competence of people, when essentially we're basically setting up situations where people need to make decisions quickly because they still have a life to get on with, and really we're not giving them the ability to discriminate between what's a genuine transaction and what somebody basically just using all those cues from a genuine transaction for a fake one.
I'm not sure if that's coming my way, but if I can just respond to it, that is essentially what you're saying is essentially my first slide. And in our previous study, we did try to get over that. The ethics committee wouldn't let us send out a real fake scam where people would actually have to send us money if they fell for it, which we wanted to do. We were going to have the money sent somewhere safe and have it returned to them, but they still didn't like that. But what we did was have two versions of it, one in which they opened an envelope and what they saw was a scam letter. And then when they turned it over to find out what to do with it, they were told, "This is an experiment, please return this questionnaire." And the other one was more like the study I've just given you, where what they got was a letter saying, "We're carrying out research on scams, please look at this fake scam letter and tell us about it." And we did get some differences in the kind of reactions to that. The most depressing difference was that we got more returns for the first type than for the second type.
So people were more likely to just throw away a letter saying, please take part in our research, than they are to just throw away a letter that say you've won £1 million. I think that's shocking.
Okay, one, two, three.
Going back to Stephen's comment on the earlier question about the context of if you're presenting something in the context of a possible deception, then yes, people, you're going to be priming people for that distinction. And the same, of course, applies to the Turing test. You know, if you are, it's actually very hard to get a computer to pass the Turing test in those conditions if you're actually alerting people to the possibility of deception. But whereas in the recent Russian chatbot that posed as a woman on an online dating site, where people weren't primed to this sort of possibility that it might actually be a chatbot they were talking to, were probably not thinking of men, but not thinking of their brains, they were very willing to sort of part with their credit cards and not spot the deception at all. So I think that is crucial, actually, to the ecological.
Chris, I'm interested in the way you present identity theft, because 6 or 7 years ago, Paul Syverson pointed out that identity theft isn't theft at all, it's actually libel. You know, 10 years ago, if someone went to the Midland Bank, pretended to be me, borrowed 10,000 and begged it, that was their problem, not mine. But now we have got this globalized system of credit reference agencies. It's somehow my identity that's been stolen, and somehow it's my problem. Now, we've tried to push the previous information commissioner to crack down on the credit reference agencies, because clearly the credit reference agency is doing something wrong if it knowingly tells bad tales about you. Do you think there might be some opportunity in the States to follow a similar line of reasoning, perhaps at the FTC?
Yes, and so most of the cases where a victim has gone to a consumer reporting agency or to a bank and said, you improperly released my credit report at the imposter's request, not mine, most of those cases have failed. However, there was a recent one that was successful called Wolf versus MBNA Bank, in which a young, MBNA Bank issued a credit card to a young man who had no job and was a college student, and everything on the application was wrong, literally. And the card was issued. This case won at the district court level, and then MBNA settled, which is really interesting. They didn't appeal. But I guess the point that I was trying to raise in that slide is, consumer reporting agencies, and more generally, let me back up and say that I like to find ways to use the law to change duties, okay? And so there are research opportunities in this field that you guys could do that would affect profoundly how consumer reporting agencies act. So for instance, consumer reporting agencies are under a statutory duty to comply with a maximum possible accuracy standard, okay? No one's laughing. So what is maximum possible accuracy? Well, it's largely what the consumer reporting agencies say it is, and we need people from the economics and computer science field to say, no, you can do more, and we can show you this model that you can do more, to kind of move practices upwards.
So if I follow pretty closely on that, so I think you did a great job within your talking as sketching, instead of kind of boiling the ocean by stopping information leaking out there, there's a way of tackling this problem in terms of scoping up the duties of credit reporting agencies and banks. And that's what you did a little bit of. Can you kind of scope out what duties, if any, are these guys held to? What are the best ways, what are the axes to pursue in terms of holding the feet to the fire, or the people who seem to be at the heart of the problem, which is credit reporting agencies and banks who are making sloppy decisions?
Their statutory duties are to follow reasonable practices, so they need to have some reasonable basis to believe that that you were the one who made the application for credit. And that's where I think where some of the problems arise. A reasonable basis is a pretty low standard in the law. the only thing that would be less would be good faith. And so how do you disprove good faith belief? Which you get an email saying, look what I did, right? But when it comes to reasonableness, experts can say, now wait a minute, you can't authenticate someone by just using the social security number, which in fact happens, or you can't authenticate someone based on guessing whether or not their date of birth falls within a range of issued social security numbers, which is also really prevalent. So I think you can get to it backwards, but there is a lot of kind of potential for the people in this room to talk about what is reasonable and what is unreasonable when it comes to authenticating people in this space.
Is there any precedent for reporting agencies being held accountable for bad information to that?
Well, if you, yes, and but in the identity theft context, there's only one case that's reported, and part of what's going on here is that some of the cases that are more egregious are probably settling.
Okay. Just apropos, you made a comment about the court saying that no damage is done because the only thing lost is your time. Have there been any cases where courts have accepted that somebody committing fraud against me has resulted in a black mark against my credit rating and resulted in my getting a worse mortgage interest rate, which can ultimately result in hundreds of thousands of dollars of loss over the course of a 30-year mortgage?
I can't immediately say that, but that proving that chain of events is difficult. So, but for you releasing this credit report and this third-party intervener, okay, this criminal acting, so are you gonna hold that credit reporting agency liable in part for what this criminal has done, and then you have to prove under some type of AB method that you would have gotten a lower interest rate? It's a hard chain to prove.
That last step is often relatively straightforward because bankers have sheets of paper printed out daily on their desk, which tells them the discount points that they get for relative credit rate. So I know that they've just got a mortgage on the safe.
I could look for a case on that, but I can't immediately conjure it.
So has anybody tried to make the time equal money? If I have posted consulting rates of X dollars an hour and I spend this much time dealing with this and this is how much loss I have, or is that just never?
Most of the cases don't get to that point because banks will frequently win this case on duty. So if I'm Bank of America and I extend a card in your name to a stranger, and you don't have an account at Bank of America, Bank of America will say, I owe you no duty. And a lot of courts have bought that argument. And I think they're missing part of the point.
But they steal money from you because they have no duty, that's what they're saying.
Validation is good. If you're more likely to have duty.
The banks are required to have a duty in order to steal money.
Yeah. So this is actually one of the weird things, is that if in some of these cases, if you were an account holder, you would have won. But since you were not an account holder, you'd lose.
That's not the view of the fraud, but that's
a weird outcome that can happen.
I was just going to comment on the presentation and just the slash at the asymmetry of the exposure risk, the banks versus the individuals. I think that was for me a big takeaway messages here. I had no idea that if I or anyone who was the victim, how little recourse they would have, I should think that from a policy standpoint, that equalizing that exposure to risk would be the way to change behavior. Not that I'm not doing it, but in other words, as I'm listening to what the banks face, from a purely selfish standpoint, I can see why they would operate. Why wouldn't they? It's amazing.
The consumers don't pay any monetary costs. So the question is do you count the consumer's time?
Well, yes. And their emotional arrangement—it's no fun. For any of us, I've had my credit card stolen and used, and it's eventually resolved. I end up paying, but it did take away my focus on for a while and my research on other things. And when I do deal with it, you can't just ignore it. Yeah, it's a puzzling
situation. Your hand up, Rachel.
Could I comment? Why shouldn't be too puzzled about the banks having